Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The debate rages on the age-old question, are humans rational or irrational? Well, rational and behavioral economists have long advocated for their own points of view on this question, but my guest today offers a different answer and a rational reason for seemingly irrational decision-making: evolution. In his new book, The Rational Animal, How Evolution Makes Us Smarter Than We Think, my guest, psychologist Douglas Kinrick, and co-author Vladis Gris-Kabesh look at how inherent biases like overconfidence bias and clustering illusions are actually designed features from a time when our survival depended on those biases. They write that because we pursue a very different evolutionary goals at different times, our decisions can change radically based on our ultimate goal. And the decision is not irrational, but predictably inconsistent. Douglas Kinrick is a professor of psychology at Arizona State University and the author of the previous book, Sex, Murder, and the Meaning of Life. The new book is again titled The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Doug Kinrick, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
This book, The Rational Animal, looks at human decision-making, and it goes over that old question, is our decisions rational or irrational? And you introduce a new element into this, the element of evolution. How does evolution play a role, and how big is that role, in our decision-making?
Well, let me give you a little background context on it. The existing perspectives, the perspectives that we're sort of arguing with, there's two prevailing views of how people make their decisions. One is it's the standard Wall Street model. It's man is a rational being who makes, you know, consciously considers all of the pros and cons and the costs and the benefits, and then makes pretty good decisions, pretty self-serving decisions designed to kind of maximize my own personal outcomes. The poster child for that viewpoint, I like to use Joseph Patrick Kennedy, who was JFK and Robert Kennedy's father, and he made a series of incredibly brilliant self-serving decisions through his life. And for example, when he was 25, he was the youngest bank president in the United States. And in those days, a guy with a good job made about $1,000 a year. When he was interviewed by the Boston newspaper and they asked, what do you want to do next? He said, I want to become a millionaire by the time I'm 35, which was a lot of money in those days. And he was the son of a bartender. And he made good on that. And then he went on to start MGM. When Hollywood was just kind of getting on a big roll, he also invested in Wall Street, and he took all his money out just before the stock crash. Out in Hollywood, he had an affair with a beautiful actress.
Gloria Swanson is one you mentioned.
Gloria Swanson, right. Yeah. And when her movie went over budget, he dropped her, and he left her holding the tab for the movie. And as he got older, he got interested in politics. He was the U.S. ambassador to Britain. And he wanted to have his oldest son, Joe Jr., become president of the United States. He started plotting that out. So it was very carefully considered, rational decisions, very self-serving, incredibly successful all throughout his life. And he sort of exemplifies the Wall Street rational model of human decision-making. Unfortunately, when psychologists and behavioral economists start to look at actual decisions, they found, well, people aren't generally all that careful and considered, and there's all kinds of biases and mistakes that we make. If you can go on Wikipedia, you'll find something like 100 different possible errors and flaws in human decision-making. There's loss aversion, there's the false consensus effect, there's the base rate fallacy, and then on and on and on. And they kind of parody the classic model as people as econs, but if you actually look at their view, it's sort of, you could call people morons. We're really just not good decision makers on this view. In fact, it's almost amazing we survived given all the flaws in our thinking processes. And I think nice poster children for that viewpoint are Joe Kennedy's descendants, the next generation. John Kennedy, you know, he made a lot of good decisions, but he also did things like using the Secret Service to cover for him while he brought women into the White House to have affairs with, and, you know, watching out for Jackie. And that didn't stand well with history. He got shot, and then his brother goes into politics. He could have just retired on the millions of dollars the family had, but he goes into politics, he gets shot. And then there's Teddy, who has his car slide, after a night of drunken reveling, he slides his car off a bridge in Chappaquiddick, and his passenger dies, and it didn't look good for him. They still talked about it until, for the rest of his life. And then their next generation did even worse. Two of Joe's kids died tragically. One was found dead in a hotel room in Miami Beach of a drug overdose. Another one was playing football on a ski slope and went slamming into a tree. Not a really good idea.
Right.
And then there's JFK's son, who goes out on a foggy night, flies his own personal plane over the Long Island Sound, and ends up down at the bottom of the Long Island Sound. So they're good poster children for, people don't seem to make rational decisions at all. So now comes in the sort of evolution angle. From an evolutionary perspective, we assume that all animals, including human beings, have brains that are designed, on average, to make good decisions, to basically help them survive, and more importantly, to help them reproduce. And so now, if you actually look at Kennedy's family, if you look at Joseph Patrick Kennedy and Rose Fitzgerald's descendants, I found at least 60 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I think there's more like 100 of them. And a lot of their descendants are in powerful positions. They're entrepreneurs. They're bank presidents. They're, film producers. They're politicians. So the family is extreme. There's a lot of them, and they're extremely well-connected. From the perspective of evolution, we ask, how well did Joe's genes do? And his genes did astoundingly well, despite the fact that some of his descendants made some dumb decisions. They also must have made an incredibly lot of good decisions, because they did survive, they did pass on, they did produce a large and prosperous family. And so an evolutionary perspective basically just says, although we probably are not like the decision makers that the bankers thought that we were, we do have a bunch of foibles. Those foibles are generally designed to lead us in the correct direction. One of the things is it's kind of fun to think about human foibles. In the book, we talk about a lot of them. Mm-hmm. We share with the behavioral economists a fascination with the dumb things that the people do. We talk about Elvis's Cadillac, that he had something like 50 or 100 Cadillacs in his life, but one of them he spent like the modern-day equivalent of $780,000 or something like that to get it painted with a paint made from pearls and diamonds and the hubcaps gold-plated. Talk about throwing money away. And MC Hammer is another favorite of people who like to think about dumb decisions. He's a guy who made millions of dollars, extremely well in the music industry, and he managed to just kind of throw it away by buying, big mansions and having a giant group of people that he was paying. Vlad and I talk about our own dumb decisions.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of those actual cognitive biases that you describe. And one that you talk quite a bit about in the book is loss aversion. Now, loss aversion is the idea that that you would actually rather be in a line and you're the 100th customer and you get $100, or being next to the guy who wins $1,000 and you get $150, you'd still probably prefer the 100 over the 150. And that throws rational economists, it drives them nuts. But that whole idea of loss aversion, and then you talk about how this works within evolution, and it's really fascinating because there is a logical reason why we have that loss aversion.
Right. So in an evolutionary perspective, we'd ask, well, what was it like for our ancestors? Well, the first thing is that our ancestors were often living kind of close to the line. In fact, modern-day anthropologists, when they study people who are living kind of close to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle that our ancestors lived, living off in the jungle somewhere and just, catching the occasional squirrel and digging for roots and so forth, which is what we all did, or all of our ancestors did. Those people are often very close to starvation. In fact, a lot of people who would have been our ancestors starved to death. But one of the things that, if you're in that kind of a circumstance, if you lose a small amount of resources, if you lose one squirrel, you might not be able to feed one of your children. If, on the other hand, you get an extra one, well, that's okay, but, you didn't necessarily need to be. It's good to be full, but it's really bad to go below the line of the minimum number of calories you needed. So you sort of expect that humans are going to pay close attention to loss aversion. But what you ask is a very good question, because it leads into the other kind of radical departure that we have with the standard models. The standard models assume that there's one person inside your head making decisions. Classic model, it's a kind of a brilliant banker. The behavioral economics model, it's kind of like someone who has a bit of brain damage and is just taking LSD. Nevertheless, there's one person in there, and on our view, that's not really the way the brain works. The brain, although it feels like there's one person running the show in there, it actually, a lot of evidence that's emerging from neuroscience and from evolutionary biology, other areas of psychology, suggests that the brain has what we call subcells. Basically, it has modules in there that are designed to deal with different kinds of problems. And so we talk about the social subcells. So there's, for example, we have one subcell that's designed to help us find a mate, another one that's designed to help us keep the mate. That's a very different set of problems, as a lot of people have learned the hard way. Then we have another set of decision-making rules that we use when we're handling our children. And if you think about the fact, for example, most people don't expect to get back on the return from their children. You might say, oh, the children bring them happiness, but even people debate that. So you're not going to get a return on your investment, and you don't expect to. You know, you give your child $100, and then they ask you for another $100. If you had a friend like that, you drop the friend. So on our model, people have different decision biases depending on what the problem is. So one of the things that we did a study looking at whether or not we could move loss aversion around. So this phenomenon you described, where people put more weight on the loss of $100 than they do on the gain of the same $100, again, irrational to an economist, we thought maybe it would jump up and down depending upon which of our subcells was kind of running the show, which of the modular decision-making systems in our brain was working, you know, in the front right now. So what we did is we brought people into the laboratory and we had them make decisions about how they would feel about losing money or losing various other kinds of resources or gaining comparable amounts of money or other resources. But before they made those decisions, we tried to activate different decision-making modules or different subcells, if you will. And the way we did that is we had some people imagine kind of a mating scenario. You've gone on vacation, you're somewhere on the beach in Mexico, we didn't actually name the place, but you're somewhere in a very exotic location. You meet somebody that you find very attractive, they find you attractive, you hit it off, you spend the whole day together. It ends with this romantic kiss on the beach. When both men and women read that, they get in a kind of a slightly sexually aroused and very romantic frame of mind. And we had other people, instead of reading that story, they would imagine themselves in the house. It's late at night, it's dark, there's nobody else there, and you start hearing these funny noises, and you think maybe somebody's trying to break in, and then you try to put it out of your head, and it becomes clearer and clearer somebody is breaking in, and now it ends when you pick up the phone, and the phone is dead, and then someone opens the door, and you hear this kind of evil laugh. There's a shadow in your door. It gives people kind of the creeps. So you got these different people. Some of the people, their self-protection module is activated. For other people, their mate acquisition module is activated. And what we find is that when people are feeling self-protective, loss aversion gets worse. They really exaggerate the importance of losses and minimize the relative importance of gains. What happens when people are in a mating frame of mind? Now, that's very interesting, and it fits with a lot of research on evolutionary biology and sex differences in mating strategies. Females don't do anything. They get a little bit, if anything, a little bit more loss averse when they're thinking about mating. Men, all of a sudden, loss aversion goes away. They stop worrying about the losses. And why is that? Well, what we think is that it fits with a lot of evidence, A, from other animal species. Throughout the animal kingdom, having a child is a different economic decision for a female mammal than for a male mammal. For a female mammal, you can use an analogy of if you're going to go out to eat tonight. And you're going to go, in Phoenix, we have an area called Scottsdale. It has a lot of nice restaurants, and that's going to cost you $100 a head to eat. You'll get a nice meal, multi-course meal with, you know, a glass of wine, and you'll enjoy yourself a lot, but it'll cost you $100 per person. Or you could just go eat at the local fast food restaurant. You could go to a taco stand. Now, if you're going to go up to Scottsdale and spend $100, you read the reviews beforehand. You go on and you see what did everybody else say about the service and the ambiance and the food. You're going to go eat at the taco stand. You're not going to even take the time to read the review. Right?
Right.
You're going to just go with, there's a taco stand. What the hell? What did I lose $4, right? And so the analogy here is that when parents are deciding about children, sometimes they're going to make a high investment and sometimes a low investment. If you're going to make a high investment, you're careful. You read the reviews. For a female, it it's always like eating in Scottsdale. In fact, eating in Scottsdale is cheap. It's like buying a restaurant in Scottsdale having a child. Right? You know, female has to carry the fetus inside of her body, and that extracts nutrition from her body. That's why females don't even get pregnant unless they have a certain amount of body fat, because our ancestors really needed to feed these hungry organisms with these growing brains inside them. Then the thing comes out and becomes a parasite, starts sucking milk right out of the mother's body, and so she needs more and more nutrition for that. And then in humans, they hang around, you know, for, you know, probably historically, at least for 10, 12, 14 years, and now, you know, it might be 30. But the female always has to pay that price. The female always has to pay a high price. For a guy, human males have two possible options. They actually can eat in the taco stand. They could, in theory, have a one-night stand. If they're in Los Angeles at a singles bar, they could possibly impregnate a woman, never see her again, and that's kind of like eating at the taco shop, okay? It's very cheap. There's no investment for the guy. But for the woman, it's still expensive. It's still buying a restaurant in Scottsdale, right? So females, and this is true throughout the animal kingdom, and especially in mammals, females are very selective about their mates. They're very careful. They pay attention to a situation like deciding, you know, about a big investment, about your retirement investment. Whereas males, they, if they're going to marry the woman, it is a big investment, and they may stay around for the rest of their lives and, you know, spend lots of money and lots of time, or there could be the short-term possibility. What's interesting is that for most mammals, you know, humans, people like to think there are a lot of deadbeat dads in the human race, and there are, but in most mammals, 95% of all mammalian species, it's all deadbeat dads and one-night stands.
Right, right. My guest today is Douglas Kindrick. He is a professor of psychology at Arizona State University, the co-author of The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you also relate a story that your co-author relates from his time on Wall Street. He had getting back to this idea of multiple selves, he had a equity investor, the top guy, who's just a hard charger, made lots of risk. He was living off risk the adrenaline rush from those decisions, and was just a hard charger from the moment he got to the office to the moment he left. But he would never bring work home because, essentially, your co-author found, he says he was two different people. He was this hard charger taking enormous risk, but he was the cuddly father and nurturing person at home. And he basically says, I got to keep these two selves separate.
Parenting self is careful. So when you're home and you hear your kids, you don't want to do crazy, risky things. You want to be careful. So, yeah, it's a good example of the multiple sub-self thing.
Now, you also spend a bit of time looking at game theory and some of the different ways in which game theory can be influenced, because you use the prisoner's dilemma, which is if you both cooperate, you get a small amount of money. If one defects and the other doesn't, you get a lot more money, and the other guy gets nothing. If both of you defect, you get nothing. And you found that how we react depends on what our relationship is to that person. For example, if you're friends, you react one way. If you're strangers, you react another. If you're kin, you act still yet another way.
Right. Generally speaking, people are, one researcher has looked at identical twins. And now for identical twins, so when you describe that, the kind of payoff matrix there, where I get a bigger reward for cheating the other person. Well, if the other person is my brother, I share 50% of his genes. So from an evolutionary perspective, every $50 I take from him, you know, is a $25 loss to myself. Whereas every $50 I give to him, that's a $25 gain. And so it's not like a total stranger where the money is worth exactly what it seems to be worth. So many, many things that seem like a prisoner's dilemma between strangers are not dilemmas for kin, because for kin, it's an easy decision. You help the person. Now, that's not always the case if the prices go high enough. You know, there's all these historical cases of, like, royal families, like Queen Cleopatra's family, if you believe the historians. They were all killing one another off. And when there's enough of a reward involved, then people can start to cheat on their brothers and sisters. But generally speaking, in everyday interactions, your brother getting a reward is half as good as you getting the same reward. And some other kind of interesting parts of the, if you think about it, about our relationships with other people in game theory terms, when you're a male courting a female, you actually want to lose something. You don't want to be just basically counting every penny and, you know, always making sure that you have a financial advantage. You, in fact, want to show off that you're willing to take some losses. So there's some other interesting research that Vlad and I did with Bob Cialdini, where we actually looked at, actually Jill Sunday, who's at the University of Texas at San Antonio, has done a lot of this work, where we activate those different subcells, and then we look at what it does to people's spending patterns. What we find is that men, when you put men in a mating frame of mind, they want to do the conspicuous consumption thing. They want to buy a round for the house. They want to buy a Rolex watch, something you'll notice. Okay, they want to spend money in ways that other people can see. Ah, and if they're going on a date, they want to spend more money on that date. They want to show off, hey, I'm the peacock. I've got, you know, pick me and your descendants will be better off.
Right. Now, does that work for women as well? When you activate their different subcells, or do they have...
We've actually done that and find the same. So we looked at a whole bunch of things. Men become more creative. At least they show off their creativity more. They actually do become more creative when they're in a romantic frame of mind. Not women. Women start off a little more creative than men, but actually in a mating frame of mind don't get more creative. Unless they're thinking about a long-term mate. They're thinking about a guy they've been dating for a while, then they'll turn on the creativity. The other thing that happens with women is when it comes to sort of spending money, women don't spend money in a flashy way when they're in a mating frame of mind, but what they do is they become more publicly altruistic, we found. That women want to give away their time, and they want to do it in a way that other people will notice. And it's sort of like, whereas the guy is saying, look at me, I'm a peacock, the woman seems to be saying, look at me, I'm a nurturing, kind, person, just exactly the kind of person you'd want as a mother for your children.
Yeah. The book is full of very interesting concepts, one which I never heard of before. It's called behavioral immune systems. And this is really cool, and it makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. I mean, when you look at, you know, I think what everybody thinks of evolution is survival and reproduction, and in your book you say it's a little more complex than that, but it's evading physical harm first, avoiding disease a second, making friends, and then gaining status and going up a role of hierarchy. It makes sense that if we see somebody who's ill, our body is going to respond. In fact, they've seen that that happens. Even seeing pictures of people who appear ill spurs white blood counts.
Yes, no, that's fascinating. That's Mark Schaller at the University of British Columbia has done that research. And it's not just that it's making somebody feel stressed, because if he scares you, if he has you, you know, show pictures of guns aiming at your face, that gets people anxious, but it doesn't spur white blood. It seems to be very specific. I think about diseases, I start to worry about disease, my body, my actual immune system, takes over and gets ready. So it's like the behavioral immune system is kind of an early warning, early detection system to either get you out of a situation where you might catch a disease or to get you ready for the possibility that a disease might be coming. It also, that one has some kind of strange and interesting consequences for things like prejudice. So what Schaller and his colleagues have found is that when people are made to worry about disease, so he does it with Canadians, and when the Canadian students worry about disease, they become a little bit more prejudiced, but in a selective way. They don't become more prejudiced against people from Hong Kong. They're familiar with people from Hong Kong because lots of Hong Kong people live now in Vancouver. They don't become more prejudiced towards people from, say, Scotland, but they do become prejudiced against people from exotic places that they haven't heard of, like Sri Lanka, or from, you know, Ethiopia, or some place that's far, far away. And what John and his colleagues argue is that when we're worried about disease, we're especially worried about people from exotic locations, because throughout history, that's been a danger to our ancestors. If you look at what happened to North American natives, there was a lot of the kind of Custer's last stand fighting thing going on, but many, many more Native Americans just lost their lives to the germs that Europeans brought over.
Right.
It was like a giant plague. When the Europeans came over, they had resistance to certain diseases and passed it on. on it, probably not purposefully, as in some of the stories go. It just was contact with a disease that you don't have a resistance to. It can be very fatal. So the mind is designed to be very sensitive to the circumstances under which I might catch a disease. Another thing that we found is that when people are thinking about disease, they kind of change their personality. They become more introverted, and they become less interested in the kind of sexual, unrestricted behaviors. In other words, they start to shift in a way that would make it so that they're less likely to get a disease.
Right. I was also struck by how marketing works in this regard, too, and it gets into another idea of the herd mentality and how if you're in a certain sub-self mood, that idea of being independent or finding the place off the beaten path that nobody's discovered, I think you use it in terms of restaurants,
right.
That would appeal to you in one frame of mind. If you're in a different frame of mind, then the most popular place is where you want to go. And it gets back to the idea of herd mentality. If you're feeling fearful about your situation, you want to go to the place that's popular because it's sort of a manifestation of this evolutionary herding syndrome. I thought that was
right.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a fun thing to do because one of our co-author on that research is a guy named Bob Cialdini. He's a very well-known researcher. He has a book that, called Influence that sold like 2 million copies. And he goes and gives talks to businesses, and he was one of Vlad's mentors. And one of the rules he has is, well, if you want to sell a product, you know, you can describe it as scarce. That's a good thing. And people, you know, so advertisers often say, oh, this is a scarce product. It's going fast. There's very few left. But other times they'll say, well, it's popular. You know, a million Frenchmen can't be wrong. But but one of the things we did that research because we suspected, as you just alluded to, that whether or not it's good to get a product that's scarce or a product that's popular is going to depend upon your frame of mind. I'm in a mating frame of mind. I want the scarce. I want the exotic restaurant that's far away. I want the scarce goods. When I'm in a self-protective frame of mind, as you pointed out, then I want to be in the place. I want to be with the herd.
Yeah. Well, it's a really fascinating book. The name of the book is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. It's a really interesting insights. Doug Kenrick, thanks very much for joining us.
Great. Good talking to you.
Douglas Kenrick is a professor of psychology at Arizona State University and co-author of The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. It's published by Basic Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs or would like to listen to an old program online, you can anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa. You can look through our archives and listen on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.